Good morning. You're going to hear the first case, and afterward there will be a short recess. We have a big crowd today, so those who aren't interested in the rest of the calendar will have a chance to file out, and then we'll reassemble. So we'll hear the first case of the morning, which is Hui versus Zhang Zim. And we have Ms. Marsh. Thank you.
Yes, good morning. Justice Sauer, Justice Mannion, and Justice Kenneth. My name is Terry Marsh, and I represent the appellants in this matter.
Speak up a little bit.
You know, actually, you can move that whole table down. There's a little button on the side. You can push that lowers itself.
I'm not good with machines.
There you go. Now, pull your finger. Now, stop it any place you want. There you go.
Oh, okay. All right.
Can
you
hear me? Now we can see, and I hope we can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Sure. Lean into it, and we're in business.
I'd like to introduce my colleague, Arping Zhang, China expert and China advisor on the case, former member of the Chinese government and graduate of, among other places, the Fletcher School, and attorney Teresa Chow, distinguished human rights attorney from Taiwan, who has also assisted with this case. We would submit today that the district court ruled incorrectly on two issues related to defendant Zhang Zemin, and as a result didn't reach the third issue, and additionally ruled incorrectly on several issues related to defendant Office 610. For these reasons, we would respectfully request reversal of the district court's dismissal of the claims against both defendants. While the head of state, or a diplomat, or a foreign official who is currently in office may indeed be immune for his official acts committed during tenure in office, there is overwhelming support in U.S. case law for the proposition that former heads of state, former foreign officials, former U.S. presidents, and former diplomats do not enjoy a permanent immunity for unofficial acts that they commit while in office. In other words, immunity is not impunity. Whether one looks at the two-part test, the sovereign immunity test of the Ninth Circuit, the First Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit, to assess immunity-based defenses in the context of former foreign officials and former heads of state, or the sovereign act test asserted in act of state defense claims in the context of former foreign officials and former heads of state, or the outer perimeter official acts test of the U.S. presidential cases, and I'm thinking of Nixon and Clinton especially, or even of the practice in the diplomatic context, there is overwhelming support for the proposition that these persons do not enjoy impunity for the unofficial acts that they committed while in office, and that unofficial acts include the crimes alleged in this case, that is torture and genocide. For example, the Ninth Circuit, in the case Haleo v. Marcus, held that, take off my glasses, I can't see you, held that the alleged crimes of murder, disappearance, and execution of a dictator are not official acts reviewable by the court, that acts that are taken beyond the statutory limitations are considered to be individual acts and not sovereign, because the officer is not doing the business which he was empowered to do. Similarly, the Fifth Circuit, in a case Jimenez v. Aristigueta, held that acts of murder and financial crimes are not sovereign acts. They are as far from official acts as acts of rape. And the court went on to state that these acts are not the acts of the Venezuela sovereign, but the common crimes of the chief of state, who is acting not in pursuance of his position, but in direct violation of it. Similarly, in the Nixon the Fitzgerald v. Nixon case, a former head of state case, the Supreme Court, in defining the outer perimeter test, instructed that the immunity's purpose must be closely related to the protective activity. the community's purpose in a former head of state context could be no more than non-interference with his duties of office. And in this case, a civil matter in which the defendant is not compelled to come to court, as Professor D'Amato noted in his reply brief, that interference would be slight. I can't imagine that the framers of that test contemplated that acts of genocide and torture against one's own citizens would be even on the outermost perimeter of that test. As I think we all know, United States presidents, former presidents, do not commit acts of genocide and torture against their own citizens. There are many cases which, in fact, emphatically note that torture is not a public act. The Supreme Court in Sidiman v. Blake stated that we know that many states commit torture is clear, but all states that do deny it. No state commits torture and claims to commit torture as a sovereign act. And the Second Circuit in Philarctica echoed that proposition. And in the case United States against Noriega, a former head of state case, the district court was careful to explain that the official acts test, which underlies all of these cases, official acts test, the question is not did the defendant use his office to commit the acts, because there are persons who use their office to commit horrible, heinous acts. The test is, did he commit these acts on behalf of Panama or on behalf of Noriega? And relevant to that point is a quote from CNN senior China analyst Willie Wei Lap Lam from July 2000, in which he said, Zhang has mobilized a Mao-era mass movement against Falun Gong. Yet the most severe criticism leveled at Zhang's handling of the Falun Gong is that he is using this persecution to promote allegiance to himself and not to China.
At what point do you distinguish the acts of the head of state as an individual or as on behalf of the country?
Well, I think that if the laws of the country are very clear that torture and genocide are illegal, in other words, if the acts of torture, for example, if the acts violate, in this case, the Constitution, prison law, penal law, treaties ratified by the government, and also if the government disavows the activity, in another case, another Falun Gong case in the Northern District of California, the Chinese government, although not a party to the matter, submitted a quasi-pleading, not really in the form of a brief, in which they stated quite clearly that they do not torture their citizens and they do not torture Falun Gong, and they disavowed torture, that torture and genocide had anything to do with the persecution. And so I would submit in a case where it is clear that the defendant is violating his own laws, clear laws, not laws difficult to discern, the Constitution, prison law, police law. Police officers cannot use interrogation methods, torture methods, to force confessions from persons in detention. And that is standard practice with Falun Gong.
Is the mere allegation in a complaint enough to establish that this person commits torture and genocide?
I think that the allegations are pretty strong in the complaint. That
they are, but it could be, say, any head of state comes to visit, and you could take about half the countries in the world where there are at least some who will allege they do just that, torture, genocide, various sundry other things. Are all of those people who would come here as heads of state to visit the president, say, vulnerable to getting a suit filed against them and served upon them?
Are you talking about persons who actually commit genocide and torture, or?
People who are alleged to have committed the complaint.
I haven't myself noticed a lot of these cases. I mean,
there are a lot of them.
I don't think it it would occur that the allegations of genocide and torture would be simply tossed around loosely by attorneys.
No. But we have lots of, for example, immigration cases. And many people who are here apply for asylum. And one of the many claims in their claim for asylum is just that, genocide and torture, if they have to return, because the government is inflicting just that on them. Now, government, head of state, whatever. So we see a lot of it in different contexts. And what I'm just asking is if any of these countries, and you can name a lot of them, if the head of state is coming here for some diplomatic head of state purpose, is in a group that is claiming this type of thing, just file a suit and get service on that head of state when they come here on that official business?
Well, I think that this case, again, is not a typical case, because it's not only the case that the acts that he committed were not official acts, so not the acts of the government, which I think is a very important point here, but he was a lame-duck president. He was at the very end of his term, and in fact should have not been head of state, given he was appointed to head of state, and he was supposed to have left in September. So he is actually a former head of state now, as the case appears before the
court. Was he head of state at the time of the events that you're complaining about?
Yes, he was. That's sort of the.
So that if his term has expired, you think he's unamenable to our process?
I'm sorry.
If his term has expired, he's no longer head of the state, he's then totally amenable to our process.
The case law, I think, is pretty clear that, and even some cases in the diplomatic context, although I don't think those are necessarily relevant, that the question is, first, is he immune?
When he was here, by the way, and you sought the service on him, was he then head of state?
Yeah, we served him when he was a lame duck head of state, and there's a number of
cases. Well, a lame duck head of state means he's head of state.
Yes, he was head of state. Yeah. Yes, I agree.
The lame duck aspect of it is has nothing to do with it.
He was head of state. There's many cases which stand for the proposition that you look first to see if the person is immune. That's the first determination.
Well, pop back to Judge Mannion's original question. Hold on a minute.
Sorry.
Pop back to Judge Mannion's original question. If a head of state is here from some country alleged to have violated people's human rights by torture and genocide, is he amenable, is that head of state, he or she, amenable to process in our country for that?
I think he is by precedent, because you have the Marcos cases. You have In Re Grand Jury, and you have Estate to Domingo. One is a district court case, one is a Fourth Circuit case, in which Marcos was held to be not immune as a former head of state, and yet in both cases he was served as head of state. And in fact, in the second case, In Re Grand Jury, the Department of Justice took.
Where was Marcos when he was? Where was he resident when he was served, Marcos?
He was served when he was head of state, and I couldn't answer that question for you. But the In Re Grand Jury, in which Marcos asserts that the case cannot go forward because he was a head of state when he was served, the Department of Justice argued the opposite side and said that he is not immune from service because he is no longer a head of state, and cited the U.S. president cases. And there's so many cases cited, especially in the Clinton v. Jones Supreme Court case, in which you see that not only are U.S. presidents served while sitting in office, and of course Clinton's an example, but going back to Jefferson, Monroe, cases I had no idea about until I started to research this, U.S. presidents have been subpoenaed, they've been forced to give video testimony, they've been deposed, they've had to submit interrogatories. So it's not unusual for a United States president to be served while in office because he's not above the law. I mean, the distinction is between England and the king, who was above the law and could never be served, and the United States president, who is subject to the law. And so if the United States president is subject to the law, why would the president of China, former president of China, be beyond the law?
Well, because he's a United States citizen and subject to the court jurisdiction of the courts of this land, but that doesn't necessarily mean vice versa, that heads of state from other countries are subject to it.
Well, it's an argument. It's not the only argument, and there's certainly other arguments. As I was saying, that former head of state Marcos was served while he was head of state, and that service was upheld. There's also a Supreme Court case.
Where was he served?
I don't know where.
Wasn't
he was
here, served. Was it?
Hawaii.
Was he served in Hawaii? Yeah, I don't know. I did talk to the lawyer about the case, and I did not ask him that question. But he was head of state when he was served. And in one of the cases, there's many Marcos cases, in one of the cases.
That means you got 5 minutes. I guess, whenever you designated the time.
Let me just 1 minute out of my rebuttal
sure.
time. There's two, even if... assuming that you were to apply the immunity analysis, the government is arguing that the suggestion of immunity does not expire, and the court doesn't address the issue. We would submit that the suggestion of immunity does expire in virtue of many cases, and especially the case that I was just referencing against Marcos, in which the court says quite clearly, this is a district court of Western Washington, the state of Washington, that the suggestion of immunity does not last beyond tenure of office. In fact, it expires. And I think we did address the third issue, which was the inviolability of service. So respectfully, I would sit down.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Lair?
May it please the court, I'm Douglas Letter from the United States Department of Justice, representing the amicus United States in these proceedings. We wish to thank the court for giving us time to appear here as amicus. Let me start out by saying, as we've said in our brief, the United States government at its very highest levels, we're talking about the President of the United States and the Secretary of State, have severely criticized publicly the Chinese government for its human rights abuses of the Falun Gong. And so this is something that the United States government is well aware of and has taken very strong diplomatic steps with the Chinese government. But the legal issues here are quite separate, and they involve issues raised under our Constitution of separation of powers. I want to hit 2 points, and I'm sorry, Your Honor, I wanted to introduce Louis Yellen, also from the Department of Justice, who is with me here today at council table. I wanted to make two key points today. First, our position is that the district court correctly held that the recognized the assertion of immunity for President Zhang as head of state asserted by the executive of the United States government, and therefore dismissed the case against President Zhang. Second is that the district court, however, erred in refusing to recognize the inviolability of President Zhang. As I will explain, under Article 2, Section 3, the Constitution expressly gives to the president the ability to receive public ministers, ambassadors from foreign countries.
Well, I'm trying to understand what your argument is. So what standing do you have to raise it in this case?
We are amicus curiae, Your Honor.
Amicus, I understand that. But
right.
Wouldn't your attack be in an independent lawsuit to prevent him from requiring it?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because this is the traditional mechanism that the Supreme Court and the circuits have recognized for many, many years, for the United States to come in and assert immunity for...
The assertion of immunity doesn't bother me at all. It's the fact that he has entered an order you're discussing. You want affirmed, but part of it you want not affirmed. You want a separate section. You want... How is that combined?
Your Honor, I'm sorry if I'm being unclear. We are not asking that any part of the order not be affirmed. Remember, the district court dismissed this case,
right.
So the judgment is for dismissal. We're disagreeing with part of the reasoning of the district court is all. We are not here as amicus asking for any change in the judgment. As Your Honor is correctly pointing out, the judgment is for dismissal. Getting to the first point about the assertion of immunity for this case, The plaintiffs here are asking this court to do something completely unprecedented in American law. Despite what my friend Ms. Marsh has argued, there is no case you will find where a court of the United States has disregarded an assertion of immunity for head of state by the executive. The only time when immunity has not been recognized is if the United States is not asserting it, often because, for instance, it's not applicable, or the government itself involved has made clear that it is waiving it. So, for instance, the Marcos cases, the government of the Philippines made clear, and if you look at those decisions, you see the government of the Philippines was not asserting head of state immunity, and the executive of the United States was not asserting it. Ms. Marsh mentioned the Noriega case. Again, if you look at that, you will see the 11th Circuit opinion. The United States government took the position that Noriega was not the recognized head of state. Another case that's discussed in the briefs, the Karadzic case, involving Radovan Karadzic, the self-proclaimed head of a Bosnian state. The United States government, in its brief, was very clear. I wrote the brief, so I know it. The United States did not assert head of state immunity because we did not recognize Radovan Karadzic. There is no case, so this is completely unprecedented, to do what the plaintiffs are asking you to do in this case.
What kind of a precedent would this create? Is this, because I was asking the other side earlier, would this precedent make vulnerable any head of state that visits where someone just makes this claim of genocide and torture?
It would, Your Honor, and that is obviously when the executive of the United States decides to assert head of state immunity, there are several factors involved, and one of the key factors is that we believe it is essential for foreign heads of state to feel free to come to the United States. But even when they don't, we feel it's necessary to deal with foreign heads of state, and it would interrupt that essential diplomatic process if foreign heads of state believed that they were going to be sued in United States courts. And that is one of the principal reasons why the executive does assert immunity, even for heinous acts. Even for situations like this one or the Mugabe case pending in the Second Circuit now, where President Mugabe of Zimbabwe is accused of similarly horrible acts, but he was coming to visit the United Nations, we are the host country, and the executive decided there was an overriding interest, a diplomatic interest, in the ability to deal with heads of state, and therefore we need to assert immunity under appropriate circumstances. In this case, the circumstances are as strong probably as they could ever be. We have a foreign head of state, a government, China. Our relations with China are obviously of the most overriding importance in today's world. That foreign head of state is actually visiting the United States to meet with the President of the United States. It is difficult to conceive of a diplomatic situation more fraught with sensitivity and difficulty than this. And so under these circumstances, again, despite the fact that the President of the United States has strongly criticized China for its human rights abuses involving the Falun Gong, head of state immunity was essential here, and therefore it was asserted. Ms. Marsh mentioned the Jimenez case, an old case from the Fifth Circuit. That was a case where, again, it's right there in the opinion, the government of Venezuela sought the extradition of its former head of state, so obviously they had waived. The United States government was participating in the extradition, so the executive had decided not to recognize head of state immunity under those circumstances. In addition, you'll note that in the decision, the court mentions that the murder allegations were not part of the extradition, so that those claims were not in the case anyway. But the key is the state involved had waived and the executive was not asserting immunity. The Supreme Court has made clear in various cases, the Mexico versus Hoffman, ex parte Peru, the Lee case that we cite, that these types of immunity determinations are so bound up with foreign relations and the President's Article II powers that the courts will accept as binding the determinations made by the executive. And these are difficult determinations, make no mistake about it. Obviously, under these circumstances, it is very difficult in trying to figure out what is the best way to get China to change its policies. But the United States, that is a decision up to the President of the United States and the Secretary of State, and the Supreme Court has recognized that. Now, Ms. Marsh was also talking about, well, if the acts are horrible enough, and again, the acts alleged in this complaint are horrible, there is no doubt about that. Her assertion is, if the acts are horrible enough, then immunity does not apply. This court has rejected that argument recently. In the Sampson case, two members of this panel were on that case. Judge Mannion wrote the opinion for the court. This court rejected expressly the argument that, and I'm not sure whether I pronounce this right, Jus Cogens overrides the doctrine of immunity. And there, obviously, the allegations were as horrible as they could be. They involved the Holocaust. And yet this court said, as a matter of United States law, immunity doctrines still apply, and this court then looked at the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and the practice of the executive in determining whether immunity would be applicable. So this court has rejected already, in binding precedent, the notion that if the acts are horrible enough, standard immunity doctrines that have been recognized by the courts for many, many decades go out the window. To switch for a moment to the inviolability point, which would be an alternative ground here to support the judgment, the district court recognized that President Zhang had immunity, but then decided for its own policy reasons that it was not important enough to recognize inviolability. Here, too, we believe that is the decision for the executive. And in fact, as I mentioned at the outset, that determination is covered by the constitutional text. Article 2, Section 3 assigns to the President the authority to receive ambassadors and public ministers. Clearly, the head of state of a foreign country is equivalent to an ambassador, or is a public minister. As we cite in our brief, Supreme Court definition of public ministers in the Baez case would establish that. The President chose to receive President Zhang in this country, and President Bush then and the executive set the terms under which he could visit here, exercising his explicit Article 3, Section 2 power and determining that President Zhang would be inviolable. That means inviolable, cannot be sued, but also cannot be used as an instrument of service of process on other defendants. Now, why is this important? Several reasons. One, we, again, do not wish to interrupt the diplomatic process. As the declarations in the district court record here that we submitted by Mr. Kaiser and Mr. Bergen point out, allowing President Zhang to be served with process creates major disruptions in our dealings with the Chinese government.
Out of curiosity, just in the procedure, how is this determination presumed, or is it expressed with each visit?
It was expressed in this circumstance. Afterward, the legal advisor of the State Department wrote to the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Division at the Justice Department to assert immunity for President Zhang from this suit, and we then submitted that to the court. So there was no...
The suit was filed, so it was an existing suit?
Yes.
And so in anticipation of his coming, they made this assertion? Is that...
After
the attempt to serve, or...
Afterward, Your Honor, after the service.
Okay.
And so the assertion is made in order to protect diplomatic communication. Second, it's very important because of reciprocity concerns. As you know, our presidents travel overseas, and we believe that it is, and our presidents often engage in controversial actions. There's no doubt about that. We do not want our presidents to be subject to legal proceedings in other countries, whether it is directly as a suit or attempts to use the president to serve process, because we don't want our president to feel that he is not free to carry out the public duties for the benefit of the people of the United States.
Just back up just a minute. The act of our executive in declaring the immunity was triggered by the service on it.
That is correct, Your Honor.
But the service, you say, was improper. What would have happened if nobody had mentioned the service to him? Don't you need the service in order to stir the executive up to make the decision?
Most likely, Your Honor.
I'm not complaining about the service.
We're complaining about the service because we believe that the district court did something that is of enormous security concern to us. The district court ordered that federal diplomatic security people participate in serving process on President Jiang.
Wouldn't the way to handle that is to say, no, we won't, and let him find out what do you do with contempt?
Your Honor, in this instance, we did, the papers were attempted to be given to Secret Service agents. President Jiang departed before anything could be done.
He wasn't served.
He was not served in that way, no. And Your Honor, I just very briefly, since you have brought this up, why this is so important.
I understand the importance. Okay. I'm just trying to figure out what triggers the program and what the beef is. And if he's not been served, probably there's no real beef, is there?
That is probably right, Your Honor. And so if a case were dismissed before we even got to any of this for failure of service, obviously there's no reason for the United States government to get involved.
Did you accept that the private process server actually made service?
Your Honor, we're not taking any position whatsoever on that. We're as amicus, our concern here is the diplomatic security issues. And as we say, whether the private service was proper or not, President Jiang was inviolable. The last point I want to make, unless the court has questions, is Ms. Marsh was mentioning some other cases, prior cases involving President Marcos. At least the ones I'm aware of, the Second Circuit and the Fourth Circuit case, I think she misspoke. Both of them, the opinions by the Second and Fourth Circuit, make absolutely clear that service of process took place after Marcos was no longer head of state, after he had come to the United States. So both of those opinions were not situations where service of process occurred while President Marcos.
Which is why they weren't asserting immunity. The Philippines, that is.
I think that's a lot of it, obviously. Yes, the Philippines, there's been a revolution in the Philippines, and they. You're right, Your Honor. I believe I've made all the points that the United States government wishes. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, we believe that all our points are covered. And so we urge that the judgment here be affirmed. But as I say, we have very serious concerns regarding inviolability and the alternative service order to the extent that it causes problems for diplomatic security personnel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Marsh? You got about 4 minutes.
I wish I had time to just sit and talk with you, but obviously I don't. There's much that I would like to say that obviously.
Say what you got to say.
Yes, thank you. I would ask that you simply review the brief on the suggestion of immunity issue, where we make the argument that suggestion of immunity by legal precedent does expire upon the head of state's departure from office, and there is no case that the government has cited in which a suggestion of immunity does not expire, and we do not believe that Article 2 provisions speak to this issue whatsoever. Regarding whether the case is a political case that involves the executive branch or a legal case for the court, we would submit that The cases cited by the government in this matter are primarily pre-FSIA cases. The case just cited, the Hoffman case, Ex parte Peru, Rich v. Navarra, those cases were superseded by the FSIA. And in those cases, yes, the court says that the executive is the chess player, that the executive understands the board, and the executive needs to make the diplomatic maneuvers in foreign affairs. But then Congress said, when it passed the FSIA, very clearly that in the situation where the executive is faced with undue political and diplomatic pressure of the foreign government, their decisions are inconsistent, and that they are making decisions they would not make absent that interference, and that is this case. Similarly, the other cases that they cite, which are not pre-FSI cases, cite to the same principle, which again, I would submit has been rejected by Congress. Even though this is not an FSI case, the point is that in the context of this case, the government of China was exerting undue pressure on the executive branch. In addition, there are fundamental rights of the plaintiffs at stake in this case under the Alien Tort Claim Act, under the Torture Victim Protection Act. This case has judicially enforceable rights, clear legal standards, which the court can enforce not only in light of federal law, Alien Tort Claim Act, Torture Victim Protection Act, but in light of the tests that were presented at the outset, the immunity-impunity analysis. There's a recent case by Scalia in which he overturns Baker v. Carr because the test in Baker v. Carr could not be applied clearly and easily. But we would submit that the suggestion of immunity expired and that the case law is clear, the immunity-impunity analysis applies, and that a former head of state, because he is not immune for such official acts as a former head of state, there's a backward-looking at service, and therefore he is not immune from service. That first one determines immunity, and then service. And I'd like to just end with a quote about reciprocity from the president's father, former President Bush, in which he said, "The dangers of reciprocity are real, but these potential dangers do not concern the fundamental goals that this statute," this is when he signed the Torture Victim Protection, can I finish?
You got a minute.
Thank you. When he signed the Torture Victim Protection Act, and he said, "In this new era in which nations are turning to democratic institutions and a rule of law to which we have spent millions of dollars in Asia, we must maintain and strengthen our commitment to human rights." Thank you, sir.
Okay, thanks. So this case will be taken under advisement. As I said earlier, we're going to take a short recess, so those of you who are interested in only this case will have a chance to file out, and we'll be back in a few minutes for the other five cases.
You guys out? Okay, I'll see if we have any more.
No, of course it was not happening.